Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, your lines have been placed on listen-only until we open for questions and answers. Please be advised today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Teresa Rubio. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I appreciate you joining today's industry stakeholder call. My name is Teresa Rubio. I'm a Health Programs Coordinator in FDA's Office of Health and Constituent Affairs and will be serving as the moderator for today's call. The purpose of today's call is to discuss FDA's produce safety, foreign supplier verification, and third-party accreditation final rules under the FDA Food Safety and Modernization Act. I'm joined by Michael Taylor, the FDA's Deputy Commissioner for Food and Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Susan Main, Director of the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, Dr. Daniel McChesney, Director of the Office of Surveillance and Compliance at FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine, as well as FDA experts on the rules, Dr. Samira Sarr, Director of the Produce Safety Staff in the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, who will be talking about the produce safety rule, Brian Pendleton, Senior Policy Advisor in FDA's Office of Policy and Planning, who will be talking about the Foreign Supplier Verification Program rule, and Charlotte Kristen, Senior Policy Advisor to the Office of Food and Veterinary Medicine, who will talk about the accredited third-party certification rule. This portion of the call will be in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will open the line for questions. I'll now turn the call over to Deputy Commissioner Mike Taylor.
Thanks, Teresa, and thanks to everybody for joining today. We believe we have arrived at yet another really significant milestone for food safety and for implementing FSMA with the issuance of these three rules today. I first just want to thank everybody who has worked so hard on this, certainly the teams within FDA that have been at this for a long time and have been very persistent, very resilient, and I think creative in developing rules in response to lots of input from our community, rules that I think meet the test of being good for food safety and being workable across the whole system. And, of course, that means thanking all of you who have put so much effort into the comment process, the dialogue, the hosting of us on various and sundry farm and factory tours. We could not have done this without that sort of engagement from our industry stakeholder community. We thank you for that. The PC rules that we issued in September were a huge step because we took the preventive controls principles that had first been codified as a regulatory framework back in the 90s for meat and poultry, seafood, where HACCP was established as the regulatory framework. It was a very big step to take that framework in the guise now of FSMA and apply that to all commodities and to build this comprehensive prevention system that we've aspired to. We see the steps we're taking today to be, in a way, even more groundbreaking in that we're taking the prevention framework and philosophy and applying it to parts of the food system where we have not directly regulated before, and that's, of course, produce, safe growing practices on farms for produce, and importers, the role that U.S.-based importers now will have under the Foreign Supplier Verification Rule to take responsibility and be accountable for verifying their foreign supply chains and ensuring that food imported here meets our standards. These are huge steps. They build on, and they're possible because they build on, of course, principles and practices that many in the food industry have been observing, and certainly principles and practices that the food industry pioneered. The food, the leaders in this community really have set the standard, and so we now see our rules being the framework within which we can work with the community as a large to bring practices up to up to these appropriate norms that have evolved over the last few years. So it's a very big deal. It's obviously getting the rules out is a big step, but it is just a step. We all know how much work there is to be done to prepare for implementation. That's work with an FDA to change what we do. It's work with the industry to provide the guidance and technical assistance to facilitate compliance, working with our state partners. Certainly in the import arena, working with the import community, but also with our foreign government regulatory partners lots to do to build a system that really can succeed in what FSMA directs us to achieve, which is having a comprehensive system of prevention that assures that food is safe and has been reliably verified to be safe regardless of where it comes from. So, again, thanks to all for your engagement. We look forward to the months and years to come and certainly questions today. If you've had an initial look at the rules, you'll have plenty of other opportunities through webinars and other outreach we're planning to dig deeper, but we welcome a chance to give you some initial information today. Before we ask the folks who have constructed these rules to present, I'd like to ask Dr. Susan Main, the director of SIFSAN, to add some opening remarks. Dr. Main?
Well, thank you, Mike. The staff at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition take great pride in being involved in developing rules that will go a long way toward addressing the burden of foodborne illness in the United States. We have experience with preventive control systems for specific foods, such as seafood, juice, and eggs, but the produce safety rule moves us forward by addressing the hazards associated with raw agricultural commodities, which, as you noted, have been responsible for many outbreaks of foodborne illness over the years. Just recently, we experienced a multi-state outbreak of Salmonella puna linked to cucumbers. Late last year, a multi-state outbreak of Listeria monocytogenes linked to caramel apples, and a multi-state outbreak of Salmonella enteritidis linked to mung bean sprouts. Of course, not all outbreaks are related to produce, so our preventive controls rules are also critical in addressing these other outbreaks. And the import safety rules will address the need to target risks associated with both domestically produced and imported foods. We look forward to working with our colleagues here at FDA, with our partners in the states, and with the affected industry towards successful implementation. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Dr. Dan McChesney, my colleague at FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine.
Thank you, Susan. The Center for Veterinary Medicine has been most focused on the final rule on preventive controls for animal food, which was published in September. But the final rules on imported foods are also critical for the safety of animal food, whether it is for food-producing animals or companion animals. We know there is a link between the health of animals and humans, so it's important that we work together to create a food safety system that is comprehensible. We are incredibly proud of this effort and look forward to working with our animal food industry and our regulatory partners in state agencies as we implement these rules. I will now turn it back over to Teresa.
Thank you. I'll now turn the call over to Samir Azhar, Charlotte Kristen, and Brian Pendleton, who will highlight the key requirements for the rules. Samir?
Thank you, Teresa. And as was mentioned, the Produce Safety Rule establishes for the first time mandatory science-based standards for growing, harvesting, packing, and holding produce, particularly in five key areas shown to be routes of microbial contamination, such as agricultural water, biological soil amendments of animal origin, worker health and hygiene, domesticated and wild animals, and equipment, tools, and buildings. The rule covers a wide variety of fruits and vegetables and contains a separate set of provisions specific to the production of sprouts. I'll review briefly the major requirements and hope that you'll go to our website at fda.gov to read more about the Produce Safety Rule. I'll begin by mentioning that the definition of farm and related terms were revised in the final rule on preventive controls for human food, and that same definition is used in this rule. Operations whose facility, whose only activities are within the farm definition are not required to register with FDA as food facilities and thus are not subject to the preventive controls regulation. The first key area I'd like to highlight is the agricultural water provision area. The final rule adopts the general approach to water quality proposed in the supplemental rule with some changes to ensure flexibility. FDA has retained quantitative criteria for the microbial quality of agricultural water. The final rule establishes two sets of criteria for water that contacts growing produce, both of which are based on the presence of generic E. coli, which can indicate fecal contamination. The first set represents the central tendency of the water quality, or what the water might look like on an average day. The second measures the variability of the water. It indicates what the water might look like when adverse conditions come into play, like heavy rainfall. For the testing requirements, the final rule still bases testing frequency on the type of water used. surface or groundwater. More sampling is required for surface water because it is far more vulnerable to contamination, and therefore greater variability in generic E. coli levels is expected. There is quite a bit of flexibility provided in both water quality standards and testing criteria. For example, for use during growing activities, their water exceeds certain criteria, growers are not required to immediately discontinue the use of water. Several options in the rule provide for taking corrective action as soon as practicable, but no later than the following year to achieve the microbial quality criteria. In addition, the criteria allow for occasional high readings of generic E. coli in an appropriate context, and a farm will not have to discontinue use of its water source due to small fluctuations in water quality. And there is flexibility in the standards themselves in that growers can provide alternative criteria using a different indicator, organism, or different numerical criteria altogether, as long as they can establish that the same level of public health protection is provided. We are exploring the development of an online tool that farms can use to input their water sample data and calculate the values. The bottom line is that we're willing to work with producers on the water standards, and we want to hear from them. Another key area in the produce safety rule relates to biological soil amendments. We've set limits on detectable amounts of bacteria for processes used to treat biological soil amendments, including manure and compost. Bacteria include Listeria monocytogenes, Salmonella, fecal coliform, and E. coli 15787. The final rule requires that untreated biological soil amendments of animal origin, such as raw manure, must be applied in a manner that does not contact cover produce during application and minimizes the potential for contact with cover produce after application. FDA is conducting a risk assessment and extensive research on the days needed between the application of raw manure as a soil amendment and harvesting to reduce the risk of contamination. Meanwhile, we do not object to the farmers complying with the USDA's National Organic Program standards, which call for a 120-day interval for crops in contact with soil and 90 days for crops not in contact with soil. It's a prudent step to minimize the risk of contamination while we research the issue. We are working with the Produce Safety Alliance on a soil summit to provide the opportunity to engage stakeholders further on these issues. The final rule also has requirements for processes that are used to produce stabilized compost, which is the end product of composting. The rule includes two examples of scientifically valid composting methods that meet those standards. Stabilized compost prepared using either of these methods must be applied in a manner that minimizes the potential for contact with produce during and after application. The final rule also includes new requirements to help prevent the contamination of sprouts, which have frequently been associated with foodborne illness outbreaks. New requirements will include treating seeds, test sprout growing environments, and taking corrective action if samples test positive for bacteria. Other key areas addressed by the final rule are controls for domesticated and wild animals, worker training and health and hygiene, and equipment, tools, and buildings. There will be ample time for farmers and food producers to come into compliance. Compliance dates are staggered according to the size of business. The result is compliance periods of 4 years for very small farms, 3 years for small farms, 2 years for all other covered farms. And for certain water provisions, an extra 2 years are being provided. It's important to note that sprout requirements will need to come in compliance 1 year, will involve compliance 1 year after the rule becomes effective. I want to emphasize the effort we are putting into training and technical assistance on the rule because that effort is critical to successful implementation. We are working with cooperative extension, land-grant universities, trade association, foreign partners, and other stakeholders to develop a network of institutions that can provide technical assistance to the farming community, especially small and very small farms. This is in addition to establishing a food safety technical assistance network within the agency to provide a central source of information to stakeholders. That briefly summarizes key provisions of the final rule. I'll now turn it over to Brian to talk about the Foreign Supply Verification Program final rule.
Thank you, Samir, and thanks to everyone on the call for the opportunity to provide an overview of the final rule on Foreign Supply Verification Programs, or FSVPs. The final rule for the first time require most importers to take specific steps to verify that their suppliers are meeting U.S. food safety standards. For the purposes of FSVP, an importer is the U.S. owner or consignee of a food that's offered for import into the United States. If there's no U.S. owner or consignee at the time of entry, the importer is the U.S. agent or representative of the foreign owner or consignee at that time, as confirmed in a signed statement of consent by that person to serve as the FSVP importer. Importers are responsible for taking specific actions to ensure that they import safe food, including determining whether there are any known or reasonably foreseeable hazards in each food that require a control. In doing so, importers need to look at the biological, chemical, and physical hazards that occur naturally, are unintentionally introduced, or are intentionally introduced for purposes of economic gain. Importers also need to evaluate the risk posed by food based on the hazard analysis that was conducted, as well as the foreign supplier's performance, which includes its history of compliance with FDA food safety regulations. Importers will need to use that food and supplier evaluation to both approve their suppliers and determine appropriate supplier verification activities. In conducting those activities, the final rule gives importers the flexibility to tailor the activities to the unique food risks and the supplier characteristics. Importers can determine appropriate verification activities from among on-site auditing of foreign suppliers, sampling and testing, reviewing relevant food safety records of their supplier, or some other activity that the importer has determined to be appropriate. Under the final rule, an annual on-site audit of the supplier's facility is the default verification activity when there's a reasonable probability that exposure to a hazard controlled by the foreign supplier will result in a serious adverse health consequence or death to humans or animals. However, even in this case, the importer could use another means of verification, provided that they document that the alternate choice is appropriate based on the food and supplier evaluation and that it provides adequate assurance that the foreign supplier is producing the food in accordance with applicable U.S. safety standards. And finally, importers will need to conduct corrective actions in response to noncompliance by the supplier. That could include, depending on the circumstances, working with the supplier to correct the problem or, in some cases, even temporarily discontinuing use of a supplier until the cause of noncompliance is addressed. One of the most important changes in the final rule is that importers are not required to conduct all of these activities themselves. An importer can rely on another entity other than the foreign supplier, with certain exceptions, to conduct hazard analyses, to evaluate the food and the foreign supplier, and to determine and conduct appropriate supplier verification activities, as long as the importer reviews and assesses the relevant documentation of these activities. I should note that the final rule includes certain exemptions from the FSVP requirements, such as for juice or seafood. Importers of those foods are already subject to certain supplier verification requirements. There are exemptions for food for research, alcoholic beverages, and several others. And the final rule also has modified requirements for certain importers. These are for importers of dietary supplements, very small importers, and importers of food from certain small foreign suppliers, and importers of food from suppliers in countries with which we have a systems recognition or equivalency agreement. The revised definition of very small importer in the final rule is consistent with the definition of very small business in the preventive controls regulations. So there's an annual food ceiling of $1 million for human food, and for importers of animal food, the ceiling is $2.5 million. The compliance dates for FSVP are somewhat complex because they vary depending on whether the food being imported is subject to the preventive controls or produce safety regulations, or in some cases, to neither of those. But in general, the earliest that an importer would be required to comply with FSVP is 18 months after publication of the final rule. For the importation of food from a supplier that is subject to either the preventive controls or produce safety regulations, compliance by the importer with FSVP is required 6 months after the foreign supplier is required to comply with the relevant regulations. We are providing assistance to industry on compliance with FSVP in several ways. We're developing a draft guidance that will provide recommendations on how importers can meet the FSVP requirements. We will use the FDA Food Safety, FSMA Food Safety Technical Assistance Network, which is already providing, responding to stakeholder questions about the preventive controls regulations, to provide a central source of information to support industry understanding and implementation of FSVP. And we are collaborating with the Food Safety Preventive Controls Alliance to establish training and technical assistance programs for FSVP. That's a brief summary of the key provisions of the final rule on Form 5 verification programs. As Samir noted, we do have additional information on the FSVP final rule on our website. And with that, I'll turn it over to Charlotte Christen to talk about the accredited third-party certification regulation.
Thanks, Brian, and thanks, everyone, for joining us on the call today. The final rule on accredited third-party certification is an important part of the new import system under FSMA. I want to emphasize that participation in this program is voluntary. FDA is not requiring certification in general for imported foods. I will explain certification more in a moment. The final rule on accredited third-party certification establishes the framework, procedures, and requirements for accreditation bodies seeking recognition by FDA, as well as the requirements for third-party certification bodies seeking accreditation. A recognized accreditation body could be a foreign government agency or private third party. Excuse me. The responsibility would include assessing third-party certification bodies for accreditation and monitoring their performance, including conducting on-site observations and notifying the FDA of any change in or withdrawal of accreditations it has granted. A recognized accreditation body also would have to maintain and provide FDA access to records required to be kept under the program. Third-party certifications also would have requirements under the rule, which include performing unannounced facility audits and notifying the FDA upon discovering a condition that could cause or contribute to a serious risk to public health. They also must ensure their auditors are competent and objective, and they must verify the effectiveness of corrective actions to address identified deficiencies in audited facilities. Certifications that are produced through this program can be used for two purposes. They may be used by importers to establish their eligibility for participation in the Voluntary Qualified Importer Program, or VQIP, which offers expedited review and entry of food. They also may be used in specific circumstances where FDA has required that a food offered for importation be accompanied by a certification from an accredited third-party certification body. To promote international consistency and use an existing framework that is familiar to industry, accreditation and certification bodies will be allowed to use documentation of their conformance with ISO-IEC standards, supplemented if necessary, in meeting the program requirements under this rule. Before discussing timelines, I want to note that audits by participating certification bodies that are performed solely for FSVP or PC supplier verification purposes are outside the scope of this rule. As to timelines, FDA intends to implement this program as soon as possible after publication of the final model accreditation standards guidance and the final user fee rule, both of which will be published separately. FDA issued model accreditation standards draft guidance in July 2015 and also published a proposed rule establishing user fees for accreditation and certification bodies. Accreditation bodies could begin to apply for recognition when the program goes into effect, and third-party certification bodies could seek accreditation after one or more FDA-recognized accreditation bodies begin accepting applications. Thank you.
And thank you to all of our speakers. Now I would like to ask the operator to open up the phone lines and provide instructions for our callers who may have questions. Please state your name and the name of your organization prior to asking your question. Operator?
Thank you. And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. To withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Once again, if you have a question, please press star 1 at this time. One moment, please.
While we're waiting for questions, we will be hosting two webinars in November covering these final rules. The first webinar on the produce final rule will be held on November 17 at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, and the second webinar, on November 23 at 10 a.m. Eastern Time will cover FSVP and accredited third-party certification final rules. More information about these webinars are available on the FSMA webpage at www.fda.gov/FSMA. In addition, we are scheduling webinars and meetings around the country to meet with our stakeholders on the new rules. Initially, we'll be participating in state-hosted regional meetings focused mainly on the produce provisions, with import-focused regional meetings to follow. We also look forward to continuing discussing implementation issues on a range of topics with stakeholders, including the development of guidance documents and training to help industry implement these rules. Operator, do we have any questions in the queue?
Thank you. The first question comes from Evan Brownfield, and please state your organization.
Hi, this is Evan Brownfield. I'm with the International Center for Technology Assessment. My question is for Dr. Samir Assar. During your talk, you mentioned seed treatments and treating seeds was addressed by the final rule, but I was a little unclear as to how, and I was hoping you could expand on that.
Sure, and I certainly invite you to look at the rule for how we specifically covered seed treatment. We generally, and it's kind of a carryover from what we originally proposed, which was a carryover from our 1999 guidance that we put out, the Sprout guidance. We don't specify, we specify that you need to conduct a seed treatment, but we leave open at this point as to what the treatment should be. In other words, what compound could be utilized for that purpose, and that's an area that we are looking to further elaborate on in guidance documents. So there's a requirement that the seeds be treated prior to use, and we will address treatment options as we explore guidance development activities.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you. The next question comes from Eric Lieberman, and please state your organization.
This is Eric Lieberman, U.S. Food Imports, LLC, and this question is for Brian Pendleton. Who can perform foreign supplier verification activities other than the FSVP importer? I know there's a provision in the rule for other parties to perform those activities. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that, please.
Sure, Eric. A good example would be when an importer is importing a raw agricultural commodity, and the commodity is the consolidator or aggregator for that commodity. So rather than the importer itself going to each of those individual farms and conducting an audit or getting records from that farm, the importer could rely on the consolidator or the aggregator to do that and review the information that they would get from the consolidator.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Timothy Wells, and please state your organization.
Yeah, this is Timothy Wells with DSM. I have a question on foreign supplier verification, and we talk about evaluating risks and identifying the physical, biological, chemical risks with all the food products we import, and I'd like a little bit more understanding of what would be acceptable. Would it be only an on-site audit? Would it be having a HACCP plan for that particular imported good? What would constitute a full evaluation?
I'm not sure what you mentioned evaluation. I thought you were talking about the hazard analysis first. But if you're talking about supplier verification, again, that would depend the activities that the importer would conduct or documentation of which they would review if it was conducted by someone other than themselves would be based on the hazards associated with the food, so the risk that the food itself poses, as well as characteristics related to the foreign supplier that from which they obtain the food. So they would, in terms of deciding whether you need to do on-site auditing or annual on-site auditing or less frequent auditing coupled with some additional verification through record review or some other approach, what you need to do depends on the nature of the hazards in the food and the foreign supplier. Does that
Well, yeah, it's very helpful, and without actually visiting, it's going to be difficult to ascertain. So on-site auditing almost becomes mandated. That would be my assumption.
Well, as I mentioned, the final rule does have the default position where on-site auditing, annual on-site auditing is appropriate where there is a serious Sakota hazard, if you will, in a food. But although even there, if you have a case where the importer might have had a very long experience with a supplier and no problems, or when there were problems, they were very swiftly addressed, and the supplier has a very good record of compliance with FDA requirements, would not necessarily be unreasonable for the importer to conclude that something different from annual on-site auditing, perhaps auditing of a wider space period with additional verification measures might be appropriate.
Okay, very good.
Let me just add that throughout our implementation of FSMA, all the rules raise lots of situation-specific questions and needs for folks to get clarity about what we expect and what would work from a food safety standpoint. And so that's why there will be guidance accompanying these rules, and that's why we are open to ongoing dialogue to help people understand what these rules contemplate. We have established, I think I've already mentioned, or we will, the technical assistance network that we've set up that enables folks to go online right now through the FSMA webpage and on our website, FDA website, and register a specific question and get, again, the more specific the facts that are offered up, the more specific an answer we can give. So again, there's work ahead to be sure folks have clarity and a common understanding of what's expected.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Rene Romero, and please state your organization.
Good morning. Rene Romero with Amex International, customs broker in Otay Mesa in the San Diego area. My question has to do with the big conferences where we have foreign companies, or should I say foreign countries, that basically are exhibiting at these shows, PMA Fresh Summit, United Fresh, where they'll have a pavilion, and you have many small exhibitors. Many of those may fall under the small business category, but how are we to handle those that are outside of the small business category? Many times these shipments are entered under the bond of the customs broker, and again, these are small quantity shipments. So how should we handle those importations if we know or do not know if it's a small business category?
Well, thanks for your question, Renee. I think that if you're talking about a food that is going to be available, so distributed to customers at this trade show, that would be food that is subject to FSVP. So in that case, the importer of that food would need to conduct most of these activities related to FSVP as we mentioned. So the importer would need to do an assessment of that potential supplier of that food, and also to conduct verification of the food consistent with the FSVP regulation.
Thank you. I think that deserves some more dialogue, because like I mentioned, in many cases it's the customs broker that uses their bond, but they really don't have any other relationship with the foreign exhibitor. The relationship is with the country that is sponsoring the show. And again, in that case, it'd be difficult because there isn't an importer other than the customs broker's bond, because in those cases, those exhibitors are looking for buyers in the U.S.
Yeah, it depends on the whether the customs broker is the importer for purposes of FSVP and whether it meets the definition that we have there.
This is Mike Taylor. Let me just again offer, I agree with you, this is a topic that requires further dialogue. I think we have to be clear, though, that the fundamental principle here is for food being imported into this country, there needs to be an FSVP importer who is taking responsibility for its safety. And we recognize there are people bringing food into the country now who don't see themselves in that business, and that's going to require some evolution of practices. And I think we want to deal in a practical way with the community and figure out how to make this workable. Again, one of the flexibilities we built into the rule, though, is flexibility about who actually has to do the verification. So I'm just going to postulate as a possibility, and without, again, there has to be dialogue, and our SMEs and our experts, our compliance people have to be part of this, but if you're working with a country in this sort of context, you know, our rule is flexible enough so that country could be the one who is gathering information and doing verifications and providing that to the FSCP importer who would have responsibility basically for reviewing it and embracing it. But again, there's flexibility in the rule to try to work with these particular situations. And I don't know whether trade show circumstances raise particular special concerns that deserve some further thought and special thinking. But again, these are the kinds of questions we appreciate you raising, exactly the kind of questions we need to be in dialogue on. We think this rule and our intent is that this rule can work to improve food safety, you know, by abiding by the principles that someone in the U.S. has to take responsibility for food brought in from overseas, but do that in a way that doesn't unnecessarily disrupt ongoing practices of trade flowing across our borders. That's something that is important and valuable to consumers, and we don't want to disrupt, but we do need to figure out how to make this core principle of FSMA be operationalized in a way that's meaningful for food safety. So look forward to working with you on that.
Thank you both.
And the next question comes from Miley Hermida. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Miley Hermida from Hogan Levels. Thank you for taking my question. I'm wondering if you can comment on the scope of the produce safety rule and what products fall under it, which ones do not, and whether you need any documentation to not fall under the rule.
So the scope, I would certainly first invite you to participate in the webinar that's being held on November 17th, because I'll get the chance to go into far greater detail as to the scope of the rule. And during that presentation, I'll talk about those that are eligible for exemptions, those that are covered, those that are not covered, and also the criteria that we applied for establishing what we refer to as the rarely consumed raw list. Essentially what we have I'll just do a quick highlight of some of the exemptions that we have in play in the final rule. One is that if you're producing less than $25,000 of produce sales on an annual average basis, be less than or equal to, then you would not be, you would not be covered. If you meet what is referred to as the qualified exemption, also is around a total value of annual food sales, $500,000, and also is dependent on how your produce is being distributed, you would be subject to this qualified exemption. I mentioned the rarely consumed raw products. There are products that would fall into that list of rarely consumed raw. And we've done a more robust analysis of dietary consumption information to derive an updated rarely consumed raw list. And we invite you to take a look at that. And if you do fall into that core category, then you would not be subject to the rule either. And then there's a kind of a commercial processing exemption as well, where you would have to follow minimal requirements associated with assurances to that if you're producing tomatoes that are intended to be further processed with a commercial process that offers a kill step, essentially, then you would need to provide written assurances to that effect. And so, again, a lot to go over in this opportunity here, but I certainly invite you to participate in the webinar on November 17th, and we can perhaps provide more information around your questions.
Thank you. It sounds like you're fundamentally saying that the framework is the same as under the proposed rule.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Brent Kobelish, and please state your organization.
Yes, hi, this is Brent Kobelish from Cargill. First of all, thank you so much for taking the time to conduct this call. My question is around, for Brian specifically, around the FSVP. I understand under the PC rules that if you are a supplier supplying your own business under the same umbrella, you would not be exempt from documentation around preventive controls, et cetera. So my question around FSVP, if we are supplying ourselves initially from a foreign country and importing that product that is destined to one of our facilities domestically, would we be exempt?
Thanks for your question, Brent. No, that's consistent with what we did with the PC supply chain provisions. It would not be an exemption under FSVP. As we note there, as I think was noted in the preventive controls regulations, that certainly would be a consideration as to what kind of supplier verification would be needed if the supplier of the food is under the same corporate structure as the receiving facility under preventive controls, or in the case of FSVP, as the importer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question comes from Robert Hahn, and please state your organization.
Hi, this is Bob Hahn from Olson Frank Wieda Terman Matz. My question is also for Brian Pendleton. I was wondering if the final rule requires importers to send their FSVP plans and related records to FDA upon request, or whether FDA would only view them during an inspection, and also if you can say a little bit about how FDA envisions inspections of importers.
Thanks, Bob. Yes, the final rule does finalize the proposed provision that we could request for records to be sent to us rather than to review them solely on site in the course of an inspection. There's extensive discussion about that in the preamble to the final rule. Your other question?
Bob, this is Mike Taylor. On the question of how we will inspect and ensure that the importers are doing what they're supposed to do, we're developing what really will be a multifaceted compliance strategy and strategy to assure that the overall import safety system is working as intended, and that will certainly include inspections or audits of the importer's foreign supply verification program. But we look to the possibility of using other parts of the import toolkit, both pre-FISMA and post-FISMA elements, to bolster that ability to be confident that the right things are happening. It includes our field exams, which could be integrated with our oversight of foreign supplier programs. It includes foreign inspection and the possibilities of linking what we see at an importer site with what is actually happening at the foreign facility overseas. Certainly, we'll be taking into account and using as where appropriate the work of foreign governments as a further check on the system. So it'll be a multifaceted effort to be sure we can answer the question that is implicit in the whole FSMA framework of how do we have confidence that food being imported is being produced under the same standards, get the same level of public health protection as in the United States. So more to come on that. I think that's an implementation topic that we would envision as our thinking matures, having some dialogue with the industry about our plans there.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Jonathan Needham, and please state your organization.
Good afternoon. The organization is Global GAP North America, and thank you for holding this stakeholder session. I'd like to ask two questions. The first is regarding the discussion we've had about the FSVP. You've made it clear that there will be a variety of potential requirements which are basically hazard-based or specific case-based. I'd like to ask if, for this purpose, you will be publishing a specific list of high-risk vector produce or some other method.
Jonathan, are you talking about for FSVP purposes only? or
especially in that context, yes, but the broader produce rules as well. Will there be an official list of high-risk vector commodities that would necessitate a certain action plan vis-a-vis certain hazard analysis or on-site versus, you know, off-site verification? Will you specify clearly what the risks are, either by a list of commodities or specific risk vectors?
This is Mike Taylor. Let me just offer a thought, and again, happy to have some dialogue about this. Fresh produce that is going to be consumed raw, we consider, generally speaking, to be a high-risk commodity. And so in terms of the obligation of the importer, the default expectation would be an annual on-site audit. And there's some opportunities for that to be done differently under certain circumstances with certain levels of experience and documentation and so forth, and we'll have dialogue about that. You know, it's another question. We were asked just a minute ago about FDA's compliance strategy. It's another question, you know, how we would deploy our compliance efforts and whether we would be doing some prioritizing, as we always do when we enforce any regulatory framework around commodities and volumes and countries, and there'll be certainly some consideration within FDA of how we prioritize our efforts. But the basic fundamental is here that a product like that is inherently subject to microbial contamination, there needs to be some verification that the standards and practices that can make that food safe are in effect. And so, generally speaking, that's the expectation for produce.
All right, thank you. And the second question is regarding the third-party verification. Could you provide a little bit more specifics on requirements for domestic certification bodies and accreditation bodies like ANSI versus those based outside the U.S.?
Thank you for the question. So in terms of what's required in the program, the law specifically and the law and the rule both specifically speak to participation by foreign accreditation and certification bodies, and also speak to other third parties, which could include U.S.-based accreditation and certification bodies. Does that answer your question?
Well, you'll be providing more details in the second session in November, I assume?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Russell Statman, and please state your organization.
This is Russell Statman from Registrar Corp., and my question is mainly to Brian, but it may relate to produce as well. And it gets back to what Commissioner Taylor was saying, which is the enforcement mechanism. Is anything going to change at the time of entry, at the port of entry for imported goods? Is there going to be some enforcement mechanism that's built in where FDA verifies that everybody is in compliance with FSVP, or is there going to be reliance on other methods that are unrelated to the entry process? Sort of gets back to what Renee was saying before about the co-customs brokers issue. Is what the customs broker do, does that change now?
Thanks for your question, Russell. No, the FSVP regulation itself is not going to change that dynamic. The rule does require the FSVP importer to ensure that they are identified at entry as the importer of that food. You need to provide your name and your email address and your unique facility identifier, but there is not, it doesn't, FSVP regulation itself doesn't specifically establish a new enforcement mechanism to, for example, enforce compliance with FSVP. We would primarily be addressing that through inspections of importers at their, primarily where they keep their FSVP records according to the schedule that we are developing for importer inspections. But there wouldn't be a new mechanism that the regulation establishes itself with respect to verifying compliance at the border.
Okay. And if I can just follow up in the same vein, where there is no U.S. owner of the food and the foreign company has designated a U.S. agent who has to accept in writing, is FDA going to require a copy of that writing, or is there just, it's sort of an honor system that such a person has agreed in writing, and if they haven't, we'll sort it out later?
If there is any question about whether or not this person has consented to serve as the FSCP importer, we might request to see that from the importer itself, and if they have not consented, they're not going to have a copy of it because they haven't provided the written consent. So we would ask them, the foreign owner or consignee, to show that, demonstrate that they have, in fact, there's been written consent for this person to serve as a U.S. agent or representative for FSVP purposes.
Okay, but that's not going to take place at the time of entry. This is what I'm trying to get at. There's not going to be any new entry documents or data fields that have to be entered at the time of the customs entry, is what I'm pretty much asking.
Right. The rule itself doesn't require submission, for example, of this written consent to serve as a U.S. agent or representative at entry.
Yeah, so just to put it in other words, I think what you want assurance of is that we're not going to have an entry-by-entry demonstration that FSCP is being done right.
Exactly. Would there be a product detention based on the determination that there was no FSCP plan?
No. But no, that's not the case. As Brian said, the central focus will be on engaging the importers separately from entry by entry activity and really assessing their plans in an environment where we can look at records and comprehensively assess whether they have an adequate plan. That doesn't mean that we won't be sampling product and as part of continuing our oversight at the border. But in terms of the entry process per se, again, the FSCP import has to be identified, but there's not going to be an entry-by-entry verification that the importer is doing FSCP properly.
Okay. Thank you very much. Much appreciate that clarification.
Thank you. The next question comes from Sonia Salas, and please state your organization.
Thank you, Western Growers Association. And I want to thank everyone for the work and transparency in the rulemaking process before I give my comment. So the comment I have is related to the produce rule, section 112.22, that covers training personnel who conduct a cover activity. I was wondering what entities you have in mind for the cooperative agreements mentioned in this section and how this relates to the use of existing training programs or the development of region-specific training. So just I want to know if you're including additional details in your implementation guide about the use of these cooperative agreements.
Sure. Thank you, Sonia. I appreciate the positive comment. This is Samir.
Thank you, Samir.
Yes. And you may be referring to, we put out a kind of a vision document online that shared our overarching thinking with respect to training, facilitating training, and in some respects technical assistance around the produce safety rule. It shows how the alliances kind of fit in with some of the other training, potential training mechanisms, the FDA, National Coordination Center, the NIFA regional centers, the FDA center, how it all fits together. And certainly we alluded to that there will be cooperative agreements in place to facilitate training to, target audiences. And so we're still kind of working on developing the approach, developing the announcement for those training opportunities, and hopefully we will be issuing those cooperative agreements. We're kind of moving forward with those cooperative agreements very soon, and we do envision a community-based approach to facilitating training, and which involves input from industry and other stakeholders as we move forward with training. Definitely appreciate your question, but the bottom line is we will be announcing more details about the cooperative agreement soon.
Thank you. I appreciate the response.
Thank you. The next question comes from Andre Ture, and please state your organization. And please check your mute feature or lift your handset.
Yes, hello. I'm calling from Hellman Perishables, and my question relates also to the broker requirements. We are a broker company, and I'm thinking now that we're going to have FSVP, and if let's assume that importer has done everything that is required, and the supplier has finally have their certification, is there a way that we can also include the certification at the time of entry as to expedite the release of the cargo?
Thanks for your question, Andre. I mean, that's not, that certainly is not contemplated under the regulation as we drafted it. And I should note that there isn't a specific certification required for admission as under FSVP. It does not require that.
Andre, this is Mike Taylor. Let me just add, I mean, Brian's of course exactly right about what the rule does. We anticipate thinking in dialogue with the community about how we continue to refine how we target our import, our entry process, our border control activities in a way that focuses our efforts where they will do the most good from a food safety standpoint. And so one element that's certainly on the table to consider is whether a supplier has a demonstrably reliable audit, on-site audit, whether required by literally by the FSVP rule or not, but as a way to distinguish the assurances and elevate the assurances that that we can have about the safety of the product. The formal way for that to happen, of course, is this voluntary qualified importer program, which would mean that if you had an audit that was done under the accreditation program we're developing, then that is all about expediting entry. And so I would encourage you to really focus on that and look at that. But, we're open to various variations on the theme of how we take account of those who are going the extra mile to produce safe food, to demonstrate that they've done the right verifications. We want to take that into account in whatever the appropriate ways is to for all of us to be efficient in managing food safety in a trade environment. So we can have further discussion of that.
It's just as I thought how the motive for the FDA registration numbers or the initial motivation for it was to, try to identify the manufacturer and try to get a quicker analysis of the admissibility, right? So the same way, if an importer and the supplier has gone through this process of certification and all that, it can be a way to, like an FDA registration number, that you put your certificate and you're just giving more details and information that will allow you to expedite clearance. But, of course, the voluntary qualification is an extremely extra step because it's quite, for what I've seen in the proposed rules, is quite expensive to do it, and it's more like an aim to high-risk commodities.
Again, welcome further dialogue on this.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. And, operator, we'll take one final question.
Thank you. The final question comes from Christina Laut, and please state your organization.
Good afternoon. My name is Christina Laut, and I am with FedEx Express. Thank you for taking my question, which is on FDA import operations. I understand that you are taking a risk-based approach, and now I would like to understand if food entries will be processed by the FDA Predict ID tool in each port of entry within the 16 FDA import districts, or if you will have a centralized system for food that is different from other import commodities. So basically, will you have FDA import employees specialized in food and purely dedicated to that import category?
This is Mike Taylor. We're looking at each other because it's a slightly complicated question. It's a work in progress sort of question. And I don't know whether you're referring to the program alignment initiative that's going on within FDA, but we are in the process of realigning our field forces to be specialized and to be more closely linked with the centers whose public health food safety programs are being implemented. So there will be a food and feed field program linked with the Center for Food Safety, Applied Nutrition, and the Center for Veterinary Medicine. How that will play out in the context of the individuals involved in various aspects of overseeing the import program remains to be seen. We have a screening process. It's electronic. We have an inspection activity, which needs to be done in a way that's very much in line with how we look at supply verification in the domestic facility context. who's going to actually be doing what is a work in progress. And so we'll keep you posted and, you know, welcome the question. We want to be, as we go through that program alignment, it's another important change that's going on within FDA that's crucial to the success of our food safety program generally, certainly of FSMA. And we'll be, you know, welcome questions about it and dialogue as we work that through. We'll be transparent about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this concludes today's stakeholder call. Thank you for your participation and have a great day.
All participants may now disconnect. Thank you.